Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 72, section 9, which is old single column, page 817. Okay, I think we'll be finishing up this paper and hence this block of papers on civilization here this evening. We have three more specific issues that they wanted to address, maybe more to the point that they were allowed to talk about a little bit. As we see when we get to the end of the paper, they'll mention that they've come to the limits of their mandate to speak about these peoples on this other planet. But in each of these issues, we've got more opportunity to reflect on the approach that a group of mortals have taken to the very same issues that we have to address in terms of government and the regulation of a population. The same mode we have to address these things, but we have this wonderful opportunity to consider how a people that are ahead of us in philosophic recognition, how they've approached these issues. And we'll see again that they don't have some sort of magical instant everything all at once insight that they're applying. It's an evolutionary process. We'll see immediately as we start reading here how they they tried out some things and discovered there were some issues and it needed some fine tuning. As a matter of fact, we'll come across the further description of one of the more interesting differences that they've brought up to us so far. Remember back in the beginning in section 2 when they were laying out the basics of the three branches of government. That their upper and lower houses of their legislature are set up in a very different mode, predicated on subgroups within their society. They're going to come back to explaining that a little bit more here in section 9 here. So let's just jump in, I'll remind you of a couple of points that we touched on last time that apply here as we get going.
Section 9, the plan of universal suffrage. Although candidates for all public offices are restricted to graduates of the state, regional, or federal schools of statesmanship, the progressive leaders of this nation discovered a serious weakness in their plan of universal suffrage, and about 50 years ago made constitutional provision for a modified scheme of voting which embraces the following features.
Okay, so just two basic elements. You see, just like I was saying, they certainly recognize the concept of universal suffrage. You can obviously guess how they set it up in just simple terms. One person, one vote, as we always say, right? But discovered a serious weakness, okay, in that plan. Now, it says in their plan, right? Remember, the whole point is it's in the plan. If there wasn't some relevancy to us, they wouldn't be talking about it. So they're pointing out, this fact that they're ahead of us in many ways, just a little bit, allows us to the opportunity to make use of their experience rather than us having to go through, say, those 200 years and then change things like they did. At least that's the idea. But there's that, and you can see at the time of writing, relatively recent, just 50 years prior. I can't help but want to remind you, just because we're so besieged with the word, you can't help but have a response to it without even thinking about it. When they say the progressive leaders of this nation,
right? I was going
to
bring that.
Make sure that you take on that challenge that I often remind you of. Progressive, yes, but not progressivist. Right? Not this ism that we've constructed with the taking name of progress attached to it. As if anything that you apply the name progress to is by definition progressive. And you can just assume that label. I'm a progressive now. The irony is that the revelators try to bring out is, those very doctrines that we call progressive are 180 degrees. Those are retrogressive doctrines, not progressive doctrines. So our taking name is literally the difference between truth and falsehood. Gross falsehood, as they point out. Catch yourself. When you see that, it's like, oh yeah, I know what that is. And they've just affirmed everything I know about that. Right? That's going to be your just instinctual response now after well over 100 years of mankind being indoctrinated into a certain response upon hearing that word.
I think there's a positive aspect that's real and true, and it's not all progressivistness, like you're saying.
I mean, obviously, the concept of progressing, right? But see, it's the devil's in the details. That's the point the revelators make. When you don't have the wisdom, when you don't have the philosophic framework, you take the ideal of progress, and you have to translate it into some idea, and you don't recognize that in our minds, it literally rotates 180 degrees as you turn the ideal into an idea. Right? You weren't trying to rotate at 180 degrees. You have no objectivity to notice that it rotates 180 degrees, but it does. Right? There's a very difficult process, right? When you hear someone invoke that name, if there's a measure of their thoughts that are independent of the doctrines, right? They may embody some truth, right? But remember that the more it becomes not an individual with a progressive consciousness, but a group thing where there's a group effort to conform to fundamental doctrines, people that start to stray off the range get pulled back in the name of purity to the doctrine. Right, so if we had more independent thinkers, it wouldn't this warning that I'm putting out wouldn't be such an issue. It's the problem is that you get ignorance codified in these group constructs. It gets institutionalized and becomes very difficult for even the most genuinely progressive person to break out and not get drug in, right? And at least end up adopting what they don't recognize as the very opposite, of what they were setting out for. So anyway, not to belabor that, but it's an issue. We'll eventually get to the specific paragraph in the book that addresses those doctrines that are called progressive. Let's see what they, you know, what the sort of the foundational element is here to this system they've set up.
One, every man and woman of 20 years and over has one vote. Upon attaining this age, all citizens must accept membership in two voting groups. They will join the first in accordance with their economic function: industrial, professional, agricultural, or trade. They will enter the second group according to their political, philosophic, and social inclinations. All workers thus belong to some economic franchise group, and these guilds, like the non-economic associations, are regulated much as is the national government, with its threefold division of powers. Registration in these groups cannot be changed for 12 years.
Okay, so see, there it is. In the same order, you know, when they did upper house, lower house back in section 2, you've got them in that same order. That, you know, so that upper house, the upper house voting groups are the industrial, professional, agricultural, trade, etc. And then the lower house is the political, philosophic, social inclinations. And so, we were wondering, it's like, well, how is that, exactly does that all work? You see, you know, as soon as they become a voting age, you know, they must sign up for a particular group, one relative to the upper house and one relative to the lower house.
Yeah. Well, they're kind of these groups. One's like the matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
One's the industry and professional and so forth. Mm-hmm. The other's the ideal. You know, what kind of ideals a person has.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of separated instead of mashed together.
Right, and also, just like I remind everyone, when you think about what that next developmental epoch is after the material comfort era, the quest for knowledge and wisdom, you know, that it's knowledge and wisdom, not wisdom and knowledge, that the wisdom is the foundation element, the philosophy is the foundation element. You know, so the foundation element, the lower house, right, that's where philosophic is. So you see how very definitive. You know, they don't think of that as some airy-fairy nonsense, which, of course, you know, historically, there's been lots of airy-fairy nonsense in the name of the word philosophy. False metaphysics. But, it's their lower house. I mean, those elements are in their lower house. So just very interesting to, you know, think about that. And again, we see just how incredibly ubiquitous the three branches thing is, how they've got it everywhere. I mean, the complexity of that is just amazing. See, even in all of these different groupings, right, you've got the three branches. And they're obviously, you know, keeping things stable so that you don't have sort of random, you know, fickle fluctuations, you know. So, you know, you only change them every 12 years. Now, just a couple little passing elements there. The whole issue right up front there, with every man and woman of 20 years and over has one vote. We all know how quite recently we've been pondering this issue of, you know, what should the minimum voting age be. Changed our constitution to make it 18. Technically, states could make it even lower, but no state can prevent an 18-year-old from voting based on age. Notice they've set it to 20. And that's obviously not random again. We've seen this a number of times. They understand that's that's a significant age. That's the age of choice. And if you're at the age of choice or older, you get a choice.
When this was written, ours was 21.
Right. And of course, they knew what kind of tensions were even, building back then. But think about it. It's not like they don't have the very tensions that led us to change our Constitution. We just read it, right? It's in the last paragraph in the preceding section, for instance, right? You can be in the military at 18. Yeah, you need parental permission to get in there, but you can be the classic Vietnam 18, right, and be in the military, but you can't vote. Right? Or think about another thing they told you, right? 18 and older, you are required to work. And, they don't tolerate idleness, period. Remember how they were very definitive on that. Right? So you're required to work. You could be in the military, but you can't vote.
But you can't be a full-time student if you're working there, right?
Well, I mean, you might be in school, right? I mean, but just, the point is, if you're not going to school, you're working, right? And even if you are going to school, you may be working too, But anyway, the point is there is an idleness. But again, just, the fact that there's a requirement, right, that once you're 18, right, you're going to be working, period, right? If they have to put you in compulsory labor in the mines, right, you're going to be working. Right, so the government is imposing something very significant on you, but you don't have a vote. And so, the issue is right there, but they know that there's something significant about having it 20 and not 18, just like as we'll read shortly, in the Adam and Eve papers. About just how definitive 20 is in the eyes of the universe. So just note that's food for thought. They don't talk about it. Who knows? Maybe they had it younger before that and discovered a serious weakness with that. That might be something, right? We don't know.
16 is also a critical age in the
idea of
the universe, too.
Right, so there's these different ages. But anyway, they don't really explain exactly what it was before, in some of these details. They're just giving you now. And see, the very fact that there are 18s in other places that we've read, and that... Okay, well, maybe they were like we are. And they thought, well, if we're going to have them in the military, they should have a right to vote. Maybe, after 150 years or so, they decided, it's not working so well. Maybe they changed that. They don't explain it, but it's a thought. It's just food for thought. The other thing there that, is just... reminds you of how, by the time, remember, they're 18 and get out of school, high school, basically, as we would call it, they have a definitive skill. Right? It's not like us now, where you can graduate from college and you're illiterate. They have a definitive skill. And so, that first one, seems pretty straightforward. But it's more than that, right? I mean, they're not just taught some mechanical skill. They're spun up, like Gene was saying, in relationship to ideals, and reflective thinking, and they're picking, these groups that are more of the mind, right, than of the physical life. Okay. So just, again, so the reason I'm emphasizing that is, it may not be appropriate for us to do 20 for various reasons. Maybe we even recognize the wisdom of it being 21 before here. But you know, if you get a people that are much more definitively attuned to the cosmos, and hence more cosmos-like, right, you're going to have a people that are more appropriately treated like the children of Adam and Eve were, where it's definitive. And if you're younger than 20, you don't get a choice. Period. No gray area. Okay, so you know, it all works together. You have to think about this, about you know, what the context is for them to have something so you know, Adamic-like, you might say, you know, as that 20 being definitive like that. You know, they, you know, you can't, you know, that's one of the main reasons why we have the fifth epical revelation, is we have some recognition of some light and life sorts of ideas, but we're applying them way too soon. It's not that they aren't appropriate, but in due time, right? Their hour has not yet come, but we've applied them now, you know, and that's leading to an emergency. Okay, so that's the basics. What's the you know, the really fascinating thing about their quote unquote universal suffrage?
Two, upon nomination by the state governors, or by the regional executives, and by the mandate of the regional supreme councils, individuals who have rendered great service to society, or who have demonstrated extraordinary wisdom in government service, may have additional votes conferred upon them not oftener than every 5 years, and not to exceed 9 such superfranchises. The maximum suffrage of any multiple voter is 10. Scientists, inventors, teachers, philosophers, and spiritual leaders are also thus recognized and honored with augmented political power. These advanced civic privileges are conferred by the state and regional supreme councils, much as degrees are bestowed by the special colleges, and the recipients are proud to attach the symbols of such civic recognition, along with their other degrees, to their list of personal achievements.
Okay, so you know, that's, of course, the fascinating thing that everyone remembers about this, that you can have up to 10 votes per person. And, you know, there's obvious two sides of that. One, there's no way you'd want to give someone more than one vote if they haven't risen to a significant level of cosmic consciousness, you know, to support that, you know, or a difficult problem of the exaltation of mediocrity is going to become radically worse. All right, so you certainly wouldn't want to implement this until you had, like they keep emphasizing, you have all of this very definitive, high-quality education, not only K through 12, but then beyond that, like they just mentioned, you know, the preceding section, the special colleges. You know, you have to have not only the people that are going to be in office having gone through the statesmanship schools, but the general population being able to recognize the importance of that, right? The quality of that. Right? It's a general quality amongst the voters there. Now, the other thing you can think about, the flip side, is you know, when they say they discovered a serious weakness in their plan, their original plan. You know, they are working on, as we'll read here in a little bit, on improving the genetic quality of their people very definitively. But you know, they know to do it in a spread out over time, so it's not a revolutionary thing, but as evolutionary as possible to keep things stable. You know, and they may have found, you know, there is getting to be some exaltation of mediocrity here. because we aren't as all as high a quality of voter as our ideals, you know, can envision. So we need to give those of a higher quality a little bit more weight to offset. Now, you're not going to take away the vote of people, but we're just going to give, you know, more votes to those of a little higher quality to balance it out. So, you know, very interesting thing, you know, and notice it's not just related to government, like they say first, you know, but scientists, inventors, teachers, philosophers, and spiritual leaders are also thus recognized. So, but all, again, all those people are coming through this very high quality education.
Well, the leaders recognize the weakness, but they don't tell us how they affected the change. Because I can just imagine the tensions.
Yeah.
You're going to take away some of my political power?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not as good as this. Because he's more educated.
Right. But see, that's the thing. You see, again, we just, you know, obviously we couldn't do that now. but you have to have the context for that, where everyone is, you know, roughly on the same page and recognizes quality is quality. You know, it's not just, well, you know, you think you have quality, you know, says who? No, I mean, they recognize it. They can, like for instance, the employees, you know, of that, you know, where was that? The richest man on the continent works 6 hours a day in the office of his machine shop and then hastens over to the local branch of the School of Statesmanship where he seeks to qualify for public service. Right? I mean, all of his employees can see directly, you know, how the boy is hardly sleeping, right, to try to rise to this challenge. Right? They know how hard he's worked for it, and they know he deserves it, you know, the civic recognition that he's going to get. So,
yeah, when you look at the education system, that you can see that it, you know, it's not like our education where, you know, someone that gets educated doesn't necessarily know any better than someone that's not, you know, like that.
Yeah, or even worse, it's, you know, right. We've gone from, you know, it being a non-changing phenomenon to a worsening phenomenon. Now people come out of college vastly worse, you know, philosophically than they entered in. Right? It's actually corrupting our citizens now. Yeah, so anyway, but, you know, up to 10, you know, a very fascinating thing to contemplate. You know, again, you can't help but speculate that the fact that the Revelators are telling us this is probably quite common on worlds as they, you know, get pushing in past the material comfort era. Probably not unique to this particular continent, this particular world. You know, this is probably a very, very typical thing that you see on the universe of universes. I'm sure we'll eventually, you know, be there too. Okay?
3. All individuals sentenced to compulsory labor in the mines and all governmental servants supported by tax funds are, for the periods of such services, disenfranchised. This does not apply to aged persons who may be retired on pensions at 65.
Okay. I mean, the glaring one is in the middle there, where, you know, they're basically telling, you're eventually going to discover, you know, you've got plenty of evidence right now that you should have already figured this out, that you need to disenfranchise your government workers for the term of their service. Otherwise, you get a system like we're definitively getting. Right, where you just have this wonderful, you know, I scratch your back, you know, you scratch mine system that we've set up, you know, where all the people, you know, have a vast bureaucracy, you know, that becomes big enough where the you know, a political party that, you know, that agrees to give them everything they want, you know, and keeps them in power, and it's just this wonderful little system that we've, you know, we're evolving into. It's like, no. You know, while they're on the public dime, they don't get a vote. Well, gee, wouldn't there be a lot of turnover? Yeah, couldn't we use some turnover? Don't we not have entrenched bureaucracies for many reasons, including this reason, you know, that just this, you know, this this whole power structure that's built up, you know, that it basically eternalizes their, you know, their service in government. Right? It's not just the elected officials, but you know, all the bureaucrats, right? It just gets in, you know, they just get, you know, entrenched in the system. And you know, and now we even have, you know, things where you can't even fire them if you wanted to, right? So, you know, and again, that's the whole, you know, I'll scratch your back if you'll scratch mine thing, you know. I'll vote for you if you pass a law that I can't be fired. Ta-da! All right? So,
oh. But not everybody working in those systems are happy.
No.
Because, you know, they have this fellow worker who's not working, yeah. And there's a lot of tension.
Oh, yeah. That. Oh, sure. Right. But again, see, you know, that you can see, I mean, it's obvious some of the things that they discovered were serious weaknesses in the way they had it set up before. Yeah, we're already coming upon those ourselves. Okay.
4. There are 5 brackets of suffrage reflecting the average yearly taxes paid for each half-decade period. Heavy taxpayers are permitted extra votes, up to 5. This grant is independent of all other recognition, but in no case can any person cast over 10 ballots.
That one's a fun one, too, you know, in our current mentality. Yeah, you just have to chuckle about, you know, you think the other one would have been controversial, Gene. How about that one? Oh, my goodness. But, right, but again, I mean, you know, if you can imagine advancing the quality of the mortals on this planet, you know, to actually have that system where, you know, where the amount of franchise you have is proportional to how much you're putting in the coffer, right? Yeah, so just...
the way it is behind the scenes.
Right, right. Right, and you can even think about that, you know, to get it out of behind the scenes, right? Get it formalized in that front. But again, the only way you can do that is because there's such... They've challenged... The people were initially challenged, and now they're challenging themselves to be quality. I mean, the great quest of these people is quality of thinking. Right? That's why, you know, this stuff works. You know... it's not quantity of thinking like it is in the material comfort era, right, where you gain material comfort, you know, through your vast quantity of thinking. And so we honor that quantity of thinking, right? It's quality of thinking for them. So, you know, the person may be, you know, paying a lot of taxes, but there's a lot of quality behind it. It isn't just some scheming person, you know. That the last thing you'd want to do is give them more than one vote, right? Like I said, you know, for us, you know, a lot of these things would just make things geometrically worse, right? Yeah, and you'd be formalizing the behind-the-scenes stuff, right, you know, right, like you're saying. All right, and now we gotta give you a little bit more here, one more item here.
5. At the time this franchise plan was adopted, the territorial method of voting was abandoned in favor of the economic or functional system. All citizens now vote as members of industrial, social, or professional groups, regardless of their residence. Thus, the electorate consists of solidified, unified, and intelligent groups who elect only their best members to positions of governmental trust and responsibility. There is one exception to this scheme of functional or group suffrage. The election of a federal chief executive is by nationwide ballot, and no citizen casts over one vote.
Okay. So for the president, right, it's like we understand. Can you think of one thing, you know, that's long been an issue, you know, and sort of just gets ever more so all the time, you know, about the territorial method of voting. What?
Districting.
Yeah, not only districting, but, you know, the word...
Gerrymandering,
yes. All right. You know, and you've got this district, you know, this, right, this, right. All right. See, they just got rid of that whole problem by eliminating the territorial method of voting.
Huh. We could do that soon.
Yeah, see?
At least that.
See, isn't that an interesting thought? See? You know, and like they're saying, see, to have these solidified, unified, right, groups... Yeah, we have to work on the intelligence part of our groups, but but again, you know, you just ideas like that. Why do we keep forcing ourselves, into ever more convoluted, literally, geographies? That's trying to tell you something philosophically. See, it means you have a falsehood, you know, in your initial assumptions about your system, you know, your initial definitions of your system. Like I've pointed out many times, this is the thing that is so obvious in science now, because it threw out philosophy 100 years ago, right? I mean, the scientific theories, you know, begin to look like gerrymandered districts. There's these ridiculous ad hoc constructs, see? Because you don't have any sort of an oversight of a top-down philosophic perspective in play, you know, that allows you to just recognize the absurdity of that. You know, as opposed to just, well, it's always been this way, you know. It's actually, you know, kind of fun to get in there and see if you can get, get the, you know, more votes in the House so that you can gerrymander, you know. And it turns into this game, this competition, and everyone thinks it's great sport, right? Who can be clever enough to redistrict the thing, you know, so that it makes it a permanent... D or an R district, right? All right, anyway. Like I said, see, there's, you know, you're getting, you know, the backstory on why their upper house and their lower house are set up like that. Why, you know, that's so different from what we would expect. Let's see. Yep.
But it seems like there's a whole... I don't want to call it spirit or whatever, mm-hmm. but something behind their whole philosophy of government that we don't have.
A philosophy of government. Yeah, that's the main thing behind it, yeah.
But even the desire to want to participate in it,
yeah.
That we don't have.
Yeah.
The goals that they keep saying, you know, after all these things, this is some of the great things everybody tries to strive for, even the richest guy, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like everybody has this desire to want to participate,
yeah.
to make it better, it seems.
Yeah.
We don't seem to have that in our country,
yeah.
and I'm sure there are other countries around the world that do have it still, you know, and so on and so forth. And it's just sort of, we used to have it, I think in my grandfather's time, so to
yeah.
speak. It was a whole different deal.
Yeah.
But now the cream of the crop wants to,
right.
you know, sit out on their yacht.
Yeah, and again, see, that's, you know, because like we've said so many times, you know, our country was founded on foreshadowing moving out of the material comfort era and pushing into the quest for knowledge and wisdom. And... We were instilled with this, this measure that you recognize that went on for a long time of seeking for equality.
Equality or quality?
Yeah. Seeking in some way for quality, okay. you know, in what you were up to. You didn't have planned obsolescence, you know, in your devices and right. I mean, there was the concept of quality and, you know, and endurance, and that was quite universally instilled into the population. But you're correct. See, that's all evaporating, and it's not so much that it quote unquote evaporated, you know, in the sense of you're staying put and then suddenly it just disappears and you're going, well, what happened to it? Right? You went backwards, and it just naturally disappears as you go backwards because it has no way to exist as you go backwards. Right? It's a natural phenomenon when you're pushing forward. You know, if you start leaning backwards or even turning around looking backwards and going backwards, it can't exist. There's forces in play in the society that just make it so that it can't manifest. You can't get your mind to that point. Your mind is redirected away from that. Like I said, I mean, you push back and get enough of the security age things in play, and suddenly people start using the word security in everyday speech like they didn't used to. See, again, it's just their mind is in that state. There's a word that has to be said when you put the whole society in that state. It's just inescapable. There's a mechanical aspect to it like that. So, you know, we have to lean into the future again, like we used to. We have to stop being a people that are so much just looking for the delights of the moment. If we lean into the future again, quality of thought will just be there again because it's supported by your human action of orienting yourself to the future. It's just the natural part. The moment that you orient yourself to the future, there's a quality there. You take your eyes off it and the quality disappears because it can't be supported in an animal mind. There is no such thing as quality, right, in that animal mind. Right? It just doesn't exist there. So, you know, we have to recognize that, you know, a lot of this stuff that we can see sort of in the technical details doesn't have to be addressed specifically. You need to address the bigger fundamental issues, and a lot of those details will just take care of themselves. I mean, it's the same basic truth that Jesus told us 2,000 years ago. Seek first the kingdom of heaven, right? And then a lot of the details just come about naturally.
It's a value thing.
Right? I mean, you don't have to build the fruits of the Spirit. If you have a personal living philosophy, the fruits of the Spirit are automatic. You can't do anything but manifest the fruits of the Spirit if you have a source. If you don't have a source, it doesn't matter how much you try to manifest the fruits of the Spirit, you can't. You have no source for them. You can't get something from nothing. Right?
Chris,
yeah.
It seems like we have to get to this new place you're talking about, or new direction, through like just this rumbling, chaotic insecurity. Like this, the material part of it is kind of falling apart, and so instead of security, we're thinking insecurity. So
yeah, right. I mean, you say the word security because you feel insecure. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Right.
So that's a wild way to take that step.
Yeah, I mean, and
I don't even know what to think. Yeah,
you know, again, all we can hope for is that enough people wake up to. You know, the old time tensions that are in play again and recognize I don't like those tensions. Oh, and we know those tensions. Those are the tensions of people in the past. Well, what are we doing in the past? We need to go back to the future again. We need to orient ourselves to the future. These people are a people of the future. Right? They're not a people of the present, and they're certainly not a people of the past. You know how the Revelators say, it's like, well, no, I think of myself as a person of the future. That's why I'm a communist, you know, and the Revelators say, no. Communism is at the very beginning of the past. There isn't anything more primitive than that, Right? To look to communism is to look to back to square one of civilization. Right? So, you know, you can think that you're a progressive, you can think that you're looking to the future, but your ignorance, no, you know, you're 180 degrees. And you've penetrated through all of the past, all the way back to the roots. You know, you say, I'm looking to the horizon in the future. No, you're looking to the horizon in the past. That's not light and life you're looking at. That's the beginning of primitive mankind. That's pre-family. Huh. So the more you look back there, huh, our family is disappearing. Of course they are. If your ideals are pre-family, families will disappear. Right? It all happens naturally. You don't have to literally tear apart families. They can't exist. Right? For the same reason they didn't exist before they did, because they couldn't exist. And as soon as the minds moved forward to where families could exist, they existed. Right? You didn't have to pass laws and make families. They just come into existence as a natural expression of what's in the minds of the humans. So we have to remember, right, mind dominates matter. You need to set it up in the mind first, and then the matter will just follow suit. All right, then give us a couple of footnote paragraphs here.
Thus, except in the election of the chief executive, suffrage is exercised by economic, professional, intellectual, and social groupings of the citizenry. The ideal state is organic, and every free and intelligent group of citizens represents a vital and functioning organ within the larger governmental organism.
See how that's a basic philosophic thing, you know, that there's an organism, right? And you think in terms of organs coordinated into an organism. Right? That fundamental philosophic cosmic consciousness. Have you noticed that there's a word that's been repeated several times? It was up there, right, in item number one, every man and woman of 20 years and over has one vote. Upon attaining this age, all citizens must accept membership. And they keep talking about citizens. Right? See, again, you know, we all know, I don't have to belabor that. We all know we can't even hold on to that anymore. It's like, well, why should you limit voting to citizens? I mean, aren't citizens just an arbitrary designation? You know, shouldn't we go forward into a system that transcends citizens?
Like my horse.
See, again, you know, we just read about that, right? I mean, yeah, if you drop back before statehood, you don't have citizens. You just have people in a place, right? A nation is just the people of a place. And see, it's just completely natural. The moment that you lose sight of that states, you know, territorial states are ahead of mere nations, if you turn that around, your whole concept of citizens will just evaporate and no one will be able to, you know, see any meaning to that word anymore, and it'll just fall from usage. It all just happens naturally. So you can see how every little passing thing is a little reminder of how we're losing it here. Right? You can't think that getting rid of citizenship requirements is going forward. No, we just laid it out in temporal order. It's going backward. Right? Once to get to light and life, you have to maintain citizenship, right? Deep enlightened life, right? There's states with citizens. Right? If you get rid of citizenship, you can't get the light in life.
So, you know, it's, listening to you talk, it seems like pretty, we're deep duty. You know, we got major problems. And my thing hits my mind is, well, where's the spirit of truth here? In other words, if there's a really, there's some underlying truth, and the spirit of truth has been put out, you know, so everybody can access it, so to speak, throughout the whole world, you'd think, or are people just not paying attention? You'd think that the truth that's we're discarding in a way would be.
It would be very difficult in a post-pastoral age to get away from the truth. And do we not have the spirit of truth reinforcing truth? How could we lose truth? Wouldn't it be very difficult? Yeah, but remember what they say, very important, in paper 34 about the spirit of truth.
I knew you'd have a good answer.
Right? The spirit of truth is wholly limited to certain pre-existent conditions. It can't function unless, you know, and just to keep it simple, what's the basic thing that has to be in play for the spirit of truth to have a domain in which to function? You have to be taking delight in cultivating using your encirclement in the Holy Spirit. The spirit of truth functions in the context, the spirit of truth functions in the context of the functioning of the Holy Spirit. And if you aren't taking a hold of your foundational human quality, there's nothing for the spirit of truth to do but twiddle his thumbs and wait for you to establish the prerequisites for its functioning. It functions upon a foundation. It's not the foundation itself. And so that's the thing. We have the spirit of truth, but it's sad to record that so few persons on Urantia benefit from it, literally as the spirit of truth. When we all benefit from as the spirit of unification, that kind of more just immediate spirit energy, if you will, fact of it, rather than the modulation upon that foundation. I mean, the spirit of unification aspect of it immediately allows you as a seventh circler to get an adjuster. It unifies seventh circlers and adjusters, right, as the spirit of unification. You know, again, if you go up and read about the spirit of truth, you know, they tell you it's got two modes, one as the spirit of truth and the other like I'm just describing. It's got that basic mode. And we all get that by grace, just like we all get that initial encirclement of the Holy Spirit by grace, so that we have basic common sense. But see, it takes that, in order for the spirit of truth as the spirit of unification to do it, that requires that by grace encirclement in the Holy Spirit that, you know, that you have. So you've basically, until you do use the Holy Spirit above what you have by grace, there's no context for the spirit of truth to actually function as the spirit of truth. You've used up your whole capacity, right? It needs greater capacity to function as the spirit of truth. And again, see, another way you can think about it, you know, why would it not have a lot of context to function? The nucleus of the spirit of truth is faith. And I can't look up the proper definition of the word faith in the dictionary. So how much possibly could the spirit of truth function? It's a sphere about a nucleus. The nucleus of genuine faith. And I can't, it's sad to record, I can't look that up in the dictionary. That is very sad, right? That we still think that the word faith refers to credulous belief. The spirit of truth can't function about the nucleus of credulous belief. Right? It's twiddling its thumbs, waiting, right? You know, it's in the same mode that adjusters were before Pentecost, right? There's all these prerequisites, you know, that are basically equivalent to becoming a third circler, right? A thought adjuster couldn't come to someone unless they were a third circler, you know, basically. because there's no capacity for it to function in those smaller capacity minds. You know, you're given this greater, effectively, third circular capacity, at least at a foundational level, by grace now, because of the Master's seventh bestowal. He filled in the gap between seventh and third circular for you and lets you use his mind by grace to fill in that gap, to at least get an adjuster. It's going to sit there and twiddle its thumbs because you, right, it's got nothing to do besides just being there. Right? It's like, well, how do you know that? Well, remember the words they use to describe it. It's
imprisoned,
right? Right. You have this little thimble that has been crammed into, right? It's in a total straitjacket. It is, you know, you've got to have greater capacity for its arms to be able to move and do something in your mind. The Spirit of Truth is in the same straitjacket as the thought adjuster. It's imprisoned, you know, in relationship to you. You know, it's just not as literal as the imprisonment of the adjuster. The Spirit of Truth is, you know, waiting above your mind to engage your mind. This for a thought adjuster is actually down in your mind, right? Trying to somehow, you know, breathe underneath the snowfield, the avalanche that's on top of it, right?
Solitary confinement.
So, yeah, it would be, you know, see, again, it's so sad to record. That's why it's so sad to record. If we just took delight in cultivating using the Holy Spirit ministry above the basic encirclement, the Spirit of Truth and the thought adjusters that we all have by grace now could do something for us. It would make a radical transformation in our civilization if you turned on those catalytic agents that are in suspended animation right now.
You mean like the purpose of education?
Paper 16, Section 6 tells you all you have to do is one thing. Reflective thinking. Pull back on the reins of the incessant clamoring and figure out what reflective thinking is. The moment you begin to genuinely think reflectively, you'll figure out the definition of the word faith. And you'll put it in the dictionary, and now you've begun. Now you've been born again. Right?
It's almost hard to put that one into words.
I mean, think about, you'll know that mankind has really been born again when the nucleus of that born again fact is in the dictionary. When the genuine proper definition of the word faith is right there emblazoned in the dictionary, right? You know it's in these people's dictionary, right? When you go to their dictionary, it doesn't say faith equals credulous belief. Right.
That might be treason.
All right, we got one more paragraph there, don't we? Yep.
The schools of statesmanship have power to start proceedings in the state courts looking toward the disenfranchisement of any defective, idle, indifferent, or criminal individual. These people recognize that when 50% of a nation is inferior or defective and possesses the ballot, such a nation is doomed. They believe the dominance of mediocrity spells the downfall of any nation. Voting is compulsory, heavy fines being assessed against all who fail to cast their ballots.
So are those sentences in this book because they wanted to tell us their beliefs, right? These people believe those things because it's true, right? Of course, this is a revelation of truth. Right, and this is where it gets very definitive. About to get even more definitive in the next section, right? The genetic issue. Now, you notice here, they're basically talking about defective or something that's effectively defective, not degenerate. Okay, that's another issue, and we're about to read about how they deal with that issue. But you know, they're getting more. See, quality of thinking, they know is a prerequisite. this person is genetically limited, they can't manifest quality of thinking. Lots of quantity, maybe, not quality. So they don't get a vote. All right? And they recognize that, just idleness is now a sign of, of a limited mind. Indifference. Right? That's not some sort of choice. That's just an expression of the temperament of a limited mind. Criminality. Right? Genetic basis to that. Okay, so in that that mode, we move into the next discussion about dealing with crime. I've pointed out, you can go to any of the harsh paragraphs in the book, and they really speak about genetics, frankly, basically like this. And, there's words like antisocial, right, in those lists, right? They're not going to let an antisocial person vote, right? We're at the point now we have so many antisocial people voting that we want antisocial parties to validate antisocial voting. So, how they deal with crime?
It's a short one.
Yeah, they make short work of it.
Section 10, dealing with crime. The methods of this people in dealing with crime, insanity, and degeneracy, while in some ways pleasing, will no doubt in others prove shocking to most Urantians. Ordinary criminals and the defectives are placed by sexes in different agricultural colonies and are more than self-supporting. More serious habitual criminals and the incurably insane are sentenced to death in the lethal gas chambers by the courts. Numerous crimes aside from murder, including betrayal of governmental trust, also carry the death penalty, and the visitation of justice is sure and swift.
So now, see, and think about that, perhaps in a way you haven't. It's like, oh my gosh, it's so harsh. No, think about it. They're that serious about quality of thinking. They are deadly serious about the importance of quality thinking. They want to leave the material comfort behind that much. Right? That they'll take, as the revelers point out, shocking actions from our perspective. Okay, but again, notice the quality of thinking involved in this process. Okay, defective is one thing. Ordinary criminals and defectives, that's, we already talked about the, back there, remember, in other words, defective, feeble-minded, is the term they used back there for defective. The feeble-minded are trained only in agriculture and animal husbandry and are committed for life to the special custodial colonies where they are segregated by sex to prevent parenthood, which is denied all subnormals, et cetera. An example of the feeble-minded or the defective is the ordinary criminal, thinking that somehow that's appropriate. Okay. But degeneracy, I remember, like I pointed out, you can kind of think of the word defective as being a horizontal word, and you're kind of, if you're defective, you're off center horizontally. But degenerate is a vertical word, right? Where we're talking about going downward in quality, starting to play around and the boundary of animal and human, right? As you push down. The more serious habitual criminals, in other words, it's just a sign of degeneracy. It's a genetic thing. There's nothing you can do, right? Incurably insane. It's a genetic thing. That's what you mean by incurably, right? It has nothing to do with nurture, say, or something, right? It's a fundamental nature issue. It's a genetic issue. There's nothing you can do. And they're very short and sweet about that. Sure and swift, yeah. As they say there. Which we are, you know, as we've talked about many times. Even if you set aside issues like that, just anything that we might think of having the death penalty for, right? You know, we're the antithesis of sure and swift now. So it's
or any justice.
Any justice at all, right.
In fact, I don't think we have any process that's sure and swift.
Yeah, we have fewer and fewer processes that are sure and swift. See, just a sure sign that we're losing our philosophic clarity. We're
credit
befogged by much thinking.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
What was that?
There are certain
your credit
things.
Score goes.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
How quickly do you get a late fee? Can I get a late fee roll?
You said it was nothing.
Yeah, but, almost.
But just, you know, just think about that. How can you be sure and swift? You have to have this very big picture where you see things clearly. You have to have that philosophic vantage point. Think about it. We've gotten to the point now, if someone acts in a sure and swift fashion, we assume they're crazy.
Even the Romans.
Yeah, we don't even believe that someone could have a top-down point of view that could allow for a definitive sort of action or thought. And we think that, you know, again, we're befogged by much thinking. We're down in the plane. We're just totally wrapped around the axle. And we now believe that that's the way it is. Right, all there is fog. Clarity is an illusion of the past, our ignorance of our past. Right, so that we actually call sure and swift thought or action, you're beside yourself, right? Just like they did with Jesus. You know, see, we do that. It's very scary. I mean, a lot of people are terrified by someone who acts definitively now. Because they know only crazy people do that. Really intelligent people know there's wheels within wheels. It'll take decades to even think through all of the No. It's actually, if you get above it, it's trivial. And you can just act. Boom, done. But most people are terrified by such individuals.
Try war by committee.
Yeah. All right. We learned that a long time ago. Right? Yeah, so anyway.
They kind of indicate there. Something else here, too. These colonies are more than self-supporting.
Yeah.
So that's like a benchmark. It has to be self. They're not going to burden the balance of society
right. With
these subnormals or defectives or whatever they are.
Yeah.
If they can be made to be self-supporting, they will abide that with the direction.
Yeah.
But if they can't fit into this, they're going to burden the system to the great.
They're innately a burden.
Yeah. Or they're not going to help with the self-supporting aspect.
Right.
And
they just eliminate
them. Yeah.
Right. See, and we think of that as very ruthless. But see, again, they. I'm sure they learned, you know, the same way apparently we're going to have to learn. You know, assume that somehow you can have an ongoing civilization with more and more people that are literally incapable of any sort of self-supporting thing. See how long you can maintain, right? If they're not self-supporting, they're a boat anchor. Right? How long can you maintain a civilization held up by a lot of spiritual gravity if you hang that many lead weights on it? No, it'll pull it down below the level where spirit gravity can take a hold of it, and it'll just drag it down to zero. Right? The moment it drags it down below that human quality, there is no spirit gravity anymore. There's only material gravity. And it just geometrically falls.
Free fall.
Yeah, in free fall after that.
In one way or another, this has to be done. Because in natural evolution, the serious defectives in a primitive state get dealt with summarily.
Yeah.
There's no...
Right.
You know.
Right, there's no ideals to mitigate the situation,
right.
Yes.
But as we become more civilized and raise our sensibilities up, it becomes a real problem.
Yeah. See, and that's why, normally you don't have people with spiritual consciousness at the same time, you know, like we do, at the same time that you have degenerates and defectives. They've all been eliminated, you know, by the Adam and Eve dispensation and the management of things. You know, so that by the time people start getting, you know, any significant enlightenment, it's not in play. There's one race. It has a lot of, you know, genetic integrity and quality to it. The issue is not in play on a normal world. Yeah, we don't have that luxury. All right, so what else do they say here?
These people are passing out of the negative into the positive area of law, era of law. Recently, they have gone so far as to attempt the prevention of crime by sentencing those who were believed to be potential murderers and major criminals to life service in the detention colonies. If such convicts subsequently demonstrate that they have become more normal, they may be either paroled or pardoned. The homicide rate on this continent is only 1% of that among the other nations.
So again, that last line is reminding you of the predicate for this. I mean, you can't get to trying to deal with potential crime until you've dealt with actual crime. Right, but they've worked so far down the path of dealing with actual crime that they can go to the next level of subtlety, right? And begin to, it's like, well, it hasn't manifested yet, but you know, they can genetically, right? They can see the precursors, right? And so, like Gene was saying, I mean, they're going to be separated. They're not going to be killed, right? But they're going to be separated, and they're going to need to demonstrate that they can overcome by, you know, use of spirit over mind, right? That mind attuned to matter problem that they can see developing, right? You know, and that's possible. You can overcome some material limitations that your mind is inescapably attuned to with some spirit over mind. So they're given the opportunity to demonstrate that.
Quite generous, really.
Yeah. But, you know, it just reminds you of the process on every world. Right? On every world, when you read about Light and Life and they're talking about how they're very definitive about discriminating, you know, amongst the genetic quality of people. You know, these are the least genetic quality, you know, people, and so they can procreate the least. You know, remember the context there. The least genetic quality there is so much greater than the greatest genetic quality we have now. There isn't a single person on this planet that would be allowed to procreate in any world in Light and Life. Not even remotely. We're totally degenerate, all of us, relative to peoples on a world of enlightened life.
Which indicates, too, though, there are potentials. We have potentials, right. Even though we wouldn't be allowed there. We have potentials that can be nursed along as time goes on.
Right. And I mean, we all embody the potentials for a people enlightened life. You know, the people that are going to enlighten life on this planet in the future aren't imported from another world. We all have the potentials for a people enlightened life, but we can't actualize them yet. Not even close. My genetic quality is, it'd be interesting to know just how many orders of magnitude, you know, short it is of being able to actualize a light and life quality of mind.
Interesting what you just said, because in truth, most planets that achieve light and life, they are imported from another world. They're all descendants of, you know, Adam and Eve, and so therefore,
right.
So it's kind of interesting what you're saying.
Yeah,
In our case, we're not in that situation. But
yeah, and if the biology isn't literally brought in from Gerasim, in our case, you know, from this local system headquarters world, it's effectively brought in by genetic engineering on those worlds. You know, like we've all pointed out. I mean, and Adam and Eve don't produce light and life quality people. There's a lot of planetary mortal epics between the end of Adam and Eve's doings and the beginning of light and life. Right? The normal magisterial sun age, bestowal sun age, Trinity teacher sun age involves all kinds of genetic engineering to get those people to the quality that they are as they enter light and life.
But again, that
knowledge is imported, you know, like you're saying. The descending suns bring that, you know, that information to a world. Yeah.
But there's some decimal quality to doing it the way we're doing it.
We'll get to, in the final section, we'll get to the other continents. Remember we've talked about just how stark the differential is, right? I mean, 1% of the other nations, just in this one. Like I said, it's, you know, from our perspective, it's like Mad Max world, you know, on those other continents, okay? All right.
Efforts to prevent the breeding of criminals and defectives were begun over 100 years ago and have already yielded gratifying results. There are no prisons or hospitals for the insane. For one reason, there are only about 10% as many of these groups as are found on Urantia.
And so, notice that's pretty amazing. See, in just a little over 100 years' time, they've significantly got a hold of this problem by just not allowing procreation amongst the genetic criminals and defectives and stuff, right? I mean, to the point where they don't need, you know, to be putting them in prisons or, asylums anymore. But of course, you know, we're definitely still there, like they're kind of pointing out in the final sentence. You know, we need to get back to that. We've talked about that. It's ridiculous for us to think we're in light and life now and we don't need institutions. You know, everyone is equal and can just be on the streets. All right, we're going to have to get back to that. But see, we have an ideal that eventually you don't have those places. But its hour has not yet come. We implemented it, you know, in the 1970s. It's like that's a long ways away from, you know, where these people are. We need to go back to where we are naturally and think about how we get to the point where you don't need those places, and you certainly aren't putting them in prison. You know, that's one thing. You know, I mean, because we don't have institutions, eventually a lot of them end up in prison because, you know, we have nothing else to do with them. I mean, that's a terrible thing to be doing with someone like that. I mean, shouldn't you at least try to give them some way to help instead of just throwing them in a solitary confinement cell in some prison somewhere? And they can beat their head against the wall? I mean, how is that compassion?
It's not self-sustaining.
It's ridiculous what we're doing now.
Now, they separate these guys. the way they control that procreation is just the sexes don't get together.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. We got one more general topic here, of military preparedness.
Section 11, military preparedness. Graduates of the federal military schools may be commissioned as guardians of civilization in 7 ranks, in accordance with ability and experience, by the President of the National Council of Defense. This council consists of 25 members, nominated by the highest parental, educational, and industrial tribunals, confirmed by the federal Supreme Court and presided over ex officio by the Chief of Staff of Coordinated Military Affairs. Such members serve until they are 70 years of age.
Okay, I mean, the details aside, you know, for the present time, again, just look, you can see right up front how much effort to have quality is in play here. Right? I mean, the military is not a bunch of, you know, crude people that know how to pull a trigger. Right? This is high quality. Everything is being tested and constrained to be the highest quality possible. And just see, and again, think about how they think about the people in the military. They're the guardians of civilization. Right? And it's easier, like we've pointed out several times, it's easier for them on that planet to recognize that. The people on that continent are so much ahead of anyone else. Right? There is only civilization of anything that you can, you know, any degree that you would want to talk about on that one continent. Right? So they know that is it. You know, they're the guardians of civilization. Just like Abraham Lincoln said at the end of the Gettysburg Address, we've got to get back in that mentality. Right? Now, if we don't think of ourselves as the guardians of civilization, who's going to be the guardians of civilization? Okay. All you have to do is just imagine what the world would be like right now if the United States didn't exist for the, you know, for the last, you know, more than two centuries. Right? Where would things be now if there wasn't our influence? Right? I mean, what would China be like even? Right? If without our influence? I mean, yeah, it's in the same way that, you know, when men and women get together, the woman is the civilizing influence, right? There's a planetary civilizing influence, right? And the spear point of civilization is that influence. You know, it needs to guard its integrity. It needs to be, you know, that shining light on the hill, right? I mean, and those that can turn their eyes up have something to turn their eyes up to and can strive to move themselves upward, and not just resign themselves to the plane of animal existence. Someone has to be, right? I mean, in the whole local universe, is there not a light at the top of the whole structure on Salvington? Right, that everyone in the local universe turns their eyes up to and strives to reach up to. Right? You can't do it any other way. Right? There's a hierarchy in the local universe. It isn't, you know, an anarchy. It isn't a horizontal structure. Right? It's a federation. It's not a confederation. So it's a universal fact, and anyway, so that's a, you know, that's an important element. Again, you know, just you know that they the things they point out are there for us. They're not there to give you information about them. Right?
For entertainment.
Right. Just for, yeah, for yucks and giggles. Right.
Okay. The courses pursued by such commissioned officers are 4 years in length and are invariably correlated with the mastery of some trade or profession. Military training is never given without this associated industrial, scientific, or professional schooling. When military training is finished, the individual has, during his 4 years of year's course, received one half of the education imparted in any of the special schools where the courses are likewise 4 years in length. In this way, the creation of a professional military class is avoided by providing this opportunity for a large number of men to support themselves while securing the first half of a technical or professional training.
Now, see how they said men there? Mm-hmm. Like I said, it's probably, like I said, it's most likely it's a lot of men, still in the military there. But here again, you see, they know they don't want this professional military class. And so, you're basically doing half of a normal, scientific degree while you're doing your 4 years in the military. And this isn't just, the officers and, the cream on top, This is everyone. Everyone's going through this, as you'll see here in a minute. Right? Their whole military has this kind of quality. Not just a few, and then a bunch that take orders, where it's ours is not the question why, ours is but to do and die.
They're not just right? cannon fodder.
Right, they're not just cannon. I mean, everyone, no matter how lowly in the military, has an objective sense about the philosophy of war.
Military service during peacetime is purely voluntary, and the enlistments in all branches of the service are for 4 years, during which every man pursues some special line of study in addition to the mastery of military tactics. Training in music is one of the chief pursuits of the central military schools and of the 25 training camps distributed about the periphery of the continent. During periods of industrial slackness, many thousands of unemployed are automatically utilized in upbuilding the military defenses of the continent on land and sea and in the air.
Again, none of that idleness stuff, right? Everyone is employed in some productive task. See, every man pursues some line, all of them, everyone in the military. Kind of cool, music. One of the chief pursuits. You can kind of just feel how they naturally seek some balance, The military stuff, you're focused very much on gritty material details, right? It's very prosaic. You need the poetic, to balance it out. Try to maintain that cosmic consciousness, right? It can't go all to material consciousness just because you're in the military. They need to maintain their cosmic consciousness. Everyone is philosophic. It's the, it's the quest for knowledge and wisdom, if not more. As we'll see as we go forward here a little bit. Let's see, anything else there? We'll see here in a moment. And they say during peacetime, it's like, how much peacetime is there? We'll see here shortly.
The slackness of in the thousands, not in a million.
Although these people maintain a powerful war establishment as a defense against invasion by the surrounding hostile peoples, it may be recorded to their credit that they have not in over 100 years employed these military resources in an offensive war. They have become civilized to that point where they can vigorously defend civilization without yielding to the temptation to utilize their war powers in aggression. There have been no civil wars since the establishment of the United Continental State. But during the last two centuries, these people have been called upon to wage 9 fierce defensive conflicts, 3 of which were against mighty confederations of world powers. Although this nation maintains adequate defense against attack by hostile neighbors, it pays far more attention to the training of statesmen, scientists, and philosophers.
Again, so you notice how they remind you of that bottom line. I've already been stressing that all the way through. So, you know, remember they've set up the basic system we're reading about 200 years prior to the writing of this. And so over those 200 years, you know, they've left civil wars behind. Yeah, but we could tell from the stuff they said at the beginning, there was a lot of internal struggle, you know, before they set up this system. So in 200 years, they've had 9, you know, significant conflicts, and basically 3 world wars. See, you know, and in this world war, it's them against everyone else. There's not the allies, you know, like we had.
Have to take these guys off the planet.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I mean, you know, it's only when the other nations are too exhausted to throw, you know, stones that they don't get up every morning, you know, and think, how can we kill everyone on that island continent? That's all they think about. And so these poor people, right, are just in this constant state of trying to guard civilization against the black flood of ignorance, you know, from the other continents. Did you have something?
No.
Oh, okay. Let's see. That was a long paragraph. Is there any other things in there? Let's see. Everyone recognizes how, you know, we've made a significant progress over the course of our existence in the United States of moving to defensive rather than offensive use of military. I mean, you know, we eventually, you know, changed the name to the Department of Defense.
Sure.
Right? Just to indicate that transition away from thinking in such off, you know, using terms in the military in such, you know, offensive terms. We need to, you know, keep on that process. That's an appropriate evolution of war. You know, and as we've pointed out, I mean, it isn't so stark on this planet like it is on our planet like it is on this one. But, you know, because of the rebellion and default, you know, we've got people that are struggling to have clans, you know, let alone tribes, you know, very much, you know, where war is indispensable for those peoples and will be for a very, very long time. Right? On a normal world, we're talking hundreds of thousands of years, right? Where war is indispensable. Now, things will get sped up probably in various ways on this planet, but still, we have to, you know, we have to recognize that just like this island continent, we need a definitive defensive capability to be guardians of civilization. That isn't just a an intellectual, you know, exercise to guard civilization. You know, it's a very literal physical exercise, you know, on our world as well.
Something about the defensive. What about Iraq and Afghanistan? That wasn't defensive.
Well, again, you know, we you know, I mean, think about, you know, you can argue that, you know, we've failed some in this effort. But, you know, you will notice that we always attempt to at least rationalize that we're doing it for defensive reasons.
True,
see, even if you can recognize that it is just a rationalization scheme and, you know, and it might not have been for defense. But notice, see, we know we have this history where we're trying to transition. So we'll at least make some half-hearted effort to convince ourselves that it's for defensive reasons that we're, you know,
well,
taking.
It's not out to conquer this, another people.
Yeah, but right.
To take over and now have them be your territory.
Yeah, and that was the point I was just going to make.
The empire.
Right. The contrast is, even if you think that we're just rationalizing, John's point is correct. I mean, notice that, is there anyone in the country that wants to, you know, make Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria or something part of the United States? No, no one does. No one wants to conquer that and make it, you know, the 51st state.
So that might be like a silver lining, just barely.
No.
But, you know, it's a disaster and we're still in it and it costs so much money.
But see, again, it's going to be very difficult because, you know, that was the other point I was just about to bring up. Unlike this island continent, you know, they are very, you know, they're completely self-sufficient They're all there. They don't need to ever step off the island, right? For any reason. We're not like that, right? We can't isolate ourselves like that. We need to interact with the greater world. And so we're going to find ourselves in very difficult situations where, you know, we're walking around amidst those where war is still indispensable. And so we're going to, you know, it's going to be very difficult for us to be as purely defensive as they are.
Yeah, but so, where the aggressor like that and pushing for it and creating war, that's...
Well, again, you know, you might have to make difficult decisions like that. I mean, think about how aggressive it is to put people in internment camps, if you will, if they think they're going to commit a crime. See, that's a pretty aggressive act. You got to think in evolutionary terms. Eventually, we'll get to where we never, you know, send our military over to attack someone.
But they all have weapons of mass destruction, don't they?
Well, don't remember Bush was looking at the push and saying,
we don't need to get off on those. Right. I mean, it's just, you know. None of us can be so idealistic to think that this is going to be simple. It's going to be very complicated. Decisions will be made that in retrospect, you know, that it shouldn't have been made. You can't live in the past, regretting the past, whining over the present, and vainly hoping for the future. Remember, that's the, you know, they say that because all of our spiritually conscious people, people who actually have ideals in their head, instead of orienting themselves to the future, like they should be with their ideals, are looking back, regretting the past, or they're looking in the moment, whining over the present, which means there is no future. Their hopes for the future are in vain. There is no future for a people who use their spiritual consciousness on the present and the past.
Sounds like the heathen.
There is no future for those people. It doesn't matter if they talk about the future, there is no such future. Right. We can regret, you know, the past wars till we're blue in the face. What does it get us? Right.
You're not saying that we shouldn't.
We shouldn't learn.
We
should, of course,
learn
not
about history, yeah. and let that inform us as we're focusing on the future.
Yeah. See, but you have to actually look at those tribulations of the past as a positive potential in order to gain wisdom from them. If you look at them only as a negative actuality, no wisdom will result, right? If it's just something to regret, no wisdom results. And you'll just repeat it over and over and over again. Right?
Or if we rewrite history, yeah, and make it so it's all happy and gleeful.
Right, yeah, whatever. Right. Any way that the only way to gain wisdom from tribulation is when you look at tribulation as a positive potential. If you only use your spiritual consciousness as an error and evil detector and only look at that tribulation as a negative actuality, not one iota of wisdom results from that. Because, see, you can't see the positive potentiality with your eyes. Your eyes can only see the negative actuality. Your insight, right, that penetrates through the surface, through the negative actuality, sees inside of it, sees the positive potentiality inside with your insight. See, wisdom results from using your encirclement of the Holy Spirit, using your insight, using the three cosmic intuitions. So you have to let go of it as a negative actuality. Yeah, it's a negative actuality. What's your point? We don't live in light and life. Everything's a negative actuality to the eyes. What's the point of your disclosure of this?
Can that be simplified by saying only focus on the positive and as a philosophy of living your life and also energy flows where attention goes?
You can tell that I've kind of said some things, yeah. Along those lines, right? I mean, you know, and just take those thoughts out of the platitude category, right? And get a hold of them definitively. Those thoughts don't do us any good on a bumper sticker. Yeah, they need to be a living truth in our minds, not that platitude on the bumper sticker. You know, and it's, you know, you have to recognize you can't see positive. Right? I mean, remember how the relatives point out, they know that you'll go, oh, wait a minute, no, I see a positive there. Do you really? You know, have you not discovered that many things that appeared to be positive turned out to not be really positive? Like when you won the lottery? It appeared to be positive, but it wasn't really.
Has anybody ever won the lottery?
We have to stop judging things by the surface.
Who would mind trying?
Right? You can't know the reality of anything by the surface. You know, we have a tendency, if it's negative on the surface, it's really bad. If it's positive on the surface, it's really good. That's the way we judge things. The surface doesn't say anything about good or bad. You have to look inside. You've got to see the potential that it has, and how that will play out to be able to judge it. So anyway, can't go on forever on that. I'm going to keep moving. But yeah, it's extremely important to not end up in that heathen category. Like John was pointing out, he knows where I'm quoting that from. Not regretting the past, whining over the present, and vainly hoping for the future. Right? Why do you languish in futile yearning? Because you obey not the truth. Right? The truth can't be seen. You know, if you actually use the spirit of truth, that's a fourth insight, not an additional sight. You can't see truth. Right? You have to penetrate through what you can see with that fourth insight to recognize the truth of something. All right, let's keep going here. Question? Yep.
Quick question from John Stevens. He's mm-hmm. asking if you intended to say that this nation had 6 civil wars?
No, I didn't.
No.
It had 3, you know.
I said 3.
Yeah, I mean, I said it had 3 world wars, and obviously the other 6 were just, you know, lesser. I don't know what words I said anymore, but no, like they said, there's no civil wars.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, if I misspoke, I'm sorry. Sometimes I think I'm saying something and I'm not. You have to just catch me on that. Okay.
When at peace with the world, all mobile defense mechanisms are quite fully employed in trade, commerce, and recreation. When war is declared, the entire nation is mobilized. Throughout the period of hostilities, military pay obtains in all industries, and the chiefs of all military departments become members of the chief executive's cabinet.
Okay, so, I mean, it's not just in world, you know, like we know how the entire country mobilized, say, during the Second World War. Everyone was out looking for scrap metal, you know, little kids were looking for scrap metal and whatnot. But obviously, even the lesser wars for them, you know, I mean, they're kind of just this little island continent against, you know. So they have to be very focused, and everyone mobilizes, you know, to defend civilization. You know, they bring all the industries in. You know, it's just maybe just the philosophic element to take out of that. Again, just how holistically they respond, and they can, right, because they're a very philosophic people. Everything is, you know, is a whole first and parts second, and at times the wholeness is, you know, has to be very, very in play, you know, or everything's going to fall apart. You know, it'll be divide and conquer, Right? They can't be a collection of parts. They'll be easily divided and conquered by these other peoples. They have to have that holistic integrity. And they can, again, they do that. You know, the holistic integrity is in the mind first. And the matter follows suit. All right.
12. The other nations. Although the society and government of this unique people are in many respects superior to those of the Urantia nations, it should be stated that on the other continents, there are 11 on this planet, the governments are decidedly inferior to the more advanced nations of Urantia.
I've mentioned that many times. You know, there you've got the little tidbit. I don't think I've ever brought that up in advance. You know, you've got a lot more complex geography on this planet than we do. And you kind of get the sense, you know, that maybe they don't have any sort of a continent. It's like Antarctica.
And they might be a bigger planet.
Yeah, we don't know a lot of things, but they do. They do have a lot of complexity. And all you go is decidedly inferior. It's like, well, how decidedly inferior is decidedly inferior? You know, I've been trying to stress it. You'll see as they talk a little bit more. I mean, it's, you know, you got some hints with some numbers, you know, that they've given you about crime rates and stuff like that. It's very, very different on those other ones, you know, in a way that we just can't really kind of imagine, having one white dot against a black background kind of on that world.
Just now, the superior government is planning to establish ambassadorial relations with the inferior peoples. And for the first time, a great religious leader has arisen who advocates the sending of missionaries to these surrounding nations. We fear they are about to make the mistake that so many others have made when they have endeavored to force a superior culture and religion on other races. What a wonderful thing could be done on this world if this continent nation of advanced culture would only go out and bring to itself the best of the neighboring peoples, and then, after educating them, send them back as emissaries of culture to their benighted brethren. Of course, if a magisterial son should soon come to this advanced nation, great things could quickly happen on this world.
Okay, no, number of elements there. This is one of those spots where they speak to this in the book about this whole idea of ambassadorial relations and religious missionaries. You know, we fear they are about to make the mistake that so many others have made, you know, like us. This is something that really challenges our spiritual consciousness, our idealistic sensibilities. The word is mistake. The prefix mis means wrong. It means there's evil. It's like, well, I wasn't intending to manifest evil with my religious missionaries. Well, you did. Well, how did I do that? Right, I mean, they're reminding you here. You can't build something by fiat. I mean, that's the Lucifer rebellion, right, notion. Right? You have to let those people evolve. You know, you can be an inspiration. You can even do like they're saying. I mean, you know, this island continent is basically like the prince's headquarters on any world. Right, and bring people in, you know, train them up, you know, the ones that can be trained up, and send them out as lights in the darkness. If you really insert yourself in there, if you think in father-like terms instead of mother-like terms, right? God the Father-like terms instead of God the Mother-like terms, right? If you think in God the Father interventionary-like mode, like we always have, it's why the fifth epical revelation, it's the fifth epical revelation of God the Father, but we need the first epical revelation, which it is, of God the Mother. We need to understand that other mode, that patient evolutionary engagement of a people in the mother-like fashion instead of the interventionary, I'm going to send personalized adjusters, you know, to intervene in your situation. You know, that father-like interventionary fashion. You know, it literally, see, not having a balance between your two parents and being biased to God the Father doesn't, well, how could anything from God the Father, any of my relationship to God the Father, not produce goodness? No, you know, it can. Evil. You'll get the exact opposite if it's not in balance. Right?
Well, look at us.
Look at Jesus, right? I mean, again, what did Jesus say? You know, well, I'm here literally as a father-like intervention. Literally. That's why I'm here. But my hour has not yet come. Right. Which, you know, was the Father above or, you know, or was the Father in cooperative subordination, right, to the whole? Right. Right. That, you know, a father-like intervention is a part. It's not a whole. Can't be anything but. Father's the individuality of the parts. Not the whole, not the individuality of the whole. Doesn't matter if, you know, it's a personalized adjuster directly coming from the Father. It's not the whole. It's not the individuality of the whole, right? It needs to, that, all of that has to be in cooperative subordination to the whole.
So a magisterial son is not likely to come to this planet as a savior.
Yeah, we'll get.
It will come when we are ready.
Yeah, I mean, right. There's those issues. Yeah, well, let's talk about that second. We get to the magisterial son question here. Okay. So anyway, you know that point of you know you need to be thinking in more evolutionary terms and think about the way the father-like descending sons engage in the context, you know, in cooperative subordination to the whole, you know, how do they spread the revelation that they're there to be the nucleus of in this way? Bring those who can, do have eyes to see and ears to hear, bring them in. You know, nurture them upward. You know, get them to actualize their human potentials more and then send them out. The same way that Jesus brought in a few, lifted them up, sent them out. This has been modeled for us over and over again. All right. Let's see. What else do we have there? Okay. Notice how they, you know, they as they move to the end of that paragraph. You know, and then send them back as emissaries of culture to their benighted brethren. Exclamation point. Right? I mean, it doesn't even feel appropriate to have an exclamation point there. But, you know, hearken back to the context, right? I mean, it needs an exclamation point because in the name of goodness, you're spreading evil. You're disrupting. Remember, why is it evil? What you do? There's a tenuous relationship to unity in these primitive peoples that you're going to go minister to. You insert yourself into them and you disrupt that tentative relationship to unity. Disruption relative to unity, that's what evil is. It's not sin, but it's evil. Right? That's not your motive, but it is the result. Yep.
Well, and look at how many countries we've tried to go in impose democracy on when they weren't ready.
Yeah.
And so it's a good example of, you know, this is, you know, there wasn't a religious part sort of things, but from a cultural point of view, trying to get them to where we are, we forget how long it took us to get there.
You don't build nations. Nations grow. If you try to build them, that's change without growth. That's potential evil.
And they get discombobulated.
Yeah. Right, you disrupt their tentative relationship with unity. That's evil.
But I don't think people realize that until, you know, we read it in places like this. I mean, I don't think, you know, as the reflective thinkers, the few that there are, really are, have realized that until they saw the experience of what happened when they tried to do
it. This was given to us a long time ago to try to help us to learn by looking a little bit more, but we seem hell-bent on learning by leaping. Okay, then the magisterial son thing. Feel what's between the lines there from the Melchizedek author of this paper. Of course, if a magisterial son should soon come, you're going, it's not just a hypothetical thing. It's like, please, please, come soon.
It doesn't say to the world, it says to the nation.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and you can think about that. I mean, I think we talked about that before, earlier in the paper. Obviously, the magisterial son would come to this island continent. I mean, it's the only place where there's any context.
And wouldn't have any effect on the rest of the world, or would, but it'd be different?
It just, unlike a normal world where he would come and engage the whole world at once, he would be very much engaging there and having it spread out from there. You can wonder about how the magisterial son will engage this world. Obviously, it's going to not be as stark as on this planet, where it just comes to one people. Right. I mean, you got people that, it's only a few years now that they weren't in the Stone Age. That's a little bit difficult for the magisterial son to engage. So that's the sentence where you can kind of just feel that, like I've said, I mean, since we wrote this whole Guardians of Civilization thing, right, this has gotten more and more difficult because of this. They've sent people out, right? Even if those people don't pick up the civilization, they're going to begin to pick up technology.
Yeah.
Right? It's just going to exacerbate this thing where now they can gang together in a confederation and they have intercontinental ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons. Right? What kind of a dome are they going to have to build over the island continent to try to protect themselves from the onslaught? So that's why you can just, the Revelators know they can project this forward. It's like, please, come, Magisterial Son. We really need, we need some help here. All right.
This recital of the affairs of a neighboring planet is made by special permission, with the intent of advancing civilization and augmenting governmental evolution on Urantia. Much more could be narrated that would no doubt interest and intrigue Urantians, but this disclosure covers the limits of our permissive mandate.
Okay, I've been pointing that out throughout the entire paper, see? They've got this little paragraph set apart, right? And see, that's the whole point, So if I hadn't put it up front, you would at this point maybe, recognize that and go back and read the paper again with that in mind more. So,
giving you some food for thought.
Right. It's the intent of advancing civilization and augmenting governmental evolution on Urantia. And as we were reading that, I was reminded of one other little point I wanted to make because I bring it up often that I get from that preceding paragraph. That whole bit about, for the first time, a great religious leader has arisen. Remember, that's the thing about the people on this island continent. They're not like our history. They had very much philosophy first and have been slowly and stably building religion within that context. You've got this first definitive one that sort of squirting out of the sphere of philosophy, right? Religionists may not always act wisely, they may act irreligiously, but they act, right? So even internally, there may be tensions, this island continent now, that there weren't back when this was written. You know, they start getting more amped up, kind of getting ahead of themselves, getting outside of the stabilization of their philosophic sphere, right? It could produce internal tensions like we have so much in our country too. So not only internal, not only externally, but internally, see, things have probably changed a lot since this was written, and it's gotten more complicated. So again, that's why they need that philosophic uplifter, right, to help. They're going to need even greater philosophy than they can muster themselves, see, right? They basically are going to be maxing out the bottom-up evolutionary philosophy. They need that bringing philosophy down from above of the magisterial sun so they can have a bigger and more integrous sphere of philosophy to contain these more energetic phenomena. Yeah. Yep.
I remember you said religion means linked back to eternity.
Mm-hmm.
So their religions, what type of what?
Well, I mean, again, all I'm pointing out is they're going to start having kind of religion more of what we think of when we hear the word religion. You know, it's going to get a little bit of out of its focus just on your being bound back to eternity. It's going to start to get more into the temporal affairs. I mean, sending out missionaries, right, is engaging temporal material affairs, not focusing on being bound back to eternity. See, right? What we call religion is not religion. It's alligion. You know, it's not bound back to eternity. It's bound to time in front of you. You know, it's not bound back to eternity through spirit. It's bound to matter in time. And so that's what I say. See, there, that's going to start happening more, right? It takes a very solid philosophic context to keep religion properly contextualized and tied to spirit and eternity, and not have it, you know, do what's natural. You know, as a material being, you're naturally thinking about matter and time first, not spirit and eternity first, right? Genuine religion is very unnatural, and it requires that philosophic objectivity to maintain that unnaturalness of genuine religion.
And revelation.
Yeah, and revelation, right. Like I was just pointing out, the revelation like of a magisterial son is, right, gives you that bigger and more solid philosophic context. You know, very literally, he's the philosophic uplifter. See? And normally you don't get a spiritual uplifter until you first get a philosophic uplifter so that that spiritual upliftment is stable. See? So that's the other thing, see, about him skipping that. It's like, well, let me give you more spiritual juicing and you have no context, you know, for it. You know, it means you're going to act even more unwisely and more irreligiously, but boy, you're going to act. Okay. So is it going to be more difficult to be just doing war for defense? See, it's more difficult because of what Jesus did, what Michael did 2,000 years ago, to keep yourself properly philosophically constrained. Okay.
Your ancients should, however, take note that their sister sphere in the Satania family has benefited by neither magisterial nor bestowal missions of the Paradise Sons. Neither are the various peoples of Urantia set off from each other by such disparity of culture as separates the continental nation from its planetary fellows.
See, I mean, basically, you take our biggest contrast here, and the contrast there is greater than that. See? Very, that's what I'm saying. It's a very stark contrast. And you know, you can tell that not only is the contrast stark, but we aren't talking about simple little people that just want to, you know, futz around, you know, in a hunter-gatherer mode somewhere. I mean, you know, they're leaguing together into confederations and starting world wars and, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
They were mining
them to tech. They aren't just hidden and, you know, not a problem in the depths of the Brazilian jungle or something, right?
No. The pouring out of the Spirit of Truth provides the spiritual foundation for the realization of great achievements in the interests of the human race of the bestowal world. Urantia is therefore far better prepared for the more immediate realization of a planetary government with its laws, mechanisms, symbols, conventions, and language, all of which could contribute so mightily to the establishment of worldwide peace under law and could lead to the sometime dawning of a real age of spiritual striving. And such an age is the planetary threshold to the utopian ages of light and life. Presented by Melchizedek of Nebadon.
Okay, just notice how they're right there, you know, very literally referring back to the developmental epochs. You know, remember again, you know, it's paper 50, isn't it? Paper 50, section 5, if you can't remember where it is. So after the quest for knowledge and wisdom, right, is the epoch of philosophy and brotherhood. And then the age of spiritual striving, right? They just mentioned it directly, followed by the era of light and life. And, you know, that, you know, the rough parallel of that sequence to the planetary mortal epochs, you know, the dispensations. You know, that you have Adam and Eve kind of related to the material comfort era. Right? You know, they're all about the material and getting that all fixed up. And then you have a magisterial son kind of related to the quest for knowledge and wisdom. The bestowal son, the epic of philosophy and brotherhood, peace on earth, right, and brotherhood among men. The Trinity teacher sons, the age of spiritual striving, right? And then, of course, the era of light and life. So, you know, the fact that they are, you know, so definitively in the quest for knowledge and wisdom, right, on this island continent, you know, and looking forward to that magisterial son that's kind of related to that effort, see, you know, they're pushing towards that epoch of philosophy and brotherhood.
So I had a question on a different part of it. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, I'd really like to get your feedback before it gets too late.
Yep.
Immediate realization of planetary government.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been under the impression that that we're not even close to an immediate realization of planetary government. But it says we're far better prepared for the more immediate.
Yeah.
What do you think what does immediate there mean?
Well, you know, okay, more immediate. You know, it just says more immediate. And I refer to that. Remember, you know, if we would take delight in cultivating, really beginning to utilize our encirclement of the Holy Spirit beyond the grace level, it would give the context for the Spirit of Truth and the adjusters to work and catalyze, speed up, accelerate this process. That's what they're referring to. You know, if you look at the planetary mortal epochs, you think, oh my goodness, I mean, it's going to be forever before we get to light and life. You know, at least you're talking tens and tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years. Yes, but not if you have it catalyzed like we do. I mean, we've built up this huge potential. What was that?
You don't have to be at light and life for, planetary government.
Well, yeah, I mean, in some literal ways, yes. But, But I mean, they're just, see, all they're pointing out is we're to the more immediate realization. It's that whole fact that we're primed with lots of potential. Because we've been given some of the end at the beginning, as it were, you won't actualize that great potential over a long span of time as you normally would. It'll be a much shorter span of time. It'll be more immediate. That's what they're getting at, is the accelerating effect. I mean, just think fundamentally about the influence of a creator son, right? About, you know, relative to time, right? It's an accelerate. It's innately, you know, not by design, but innately an accelerating influence. So, you know, that's what they're getting at. We, you know, you can despair as you start to study that, you know, just how long it would probably take us to get to light in life. It's like, you know, how are we ever going to be patient enough? You know, we're so amped up already. But, you know, we can take heart that even though it seems like it's going to take forever, and we have people that are barely trying to be clans still, it could happen in ways that we can't even imagine, you know, in a sped-up fashion. But it probably will have some ruggedness to it. I mean, the planetary administrators, when they start to manifest, you know, literally like Machiavelli and Melchizedek, he's going to have a heavy hand on a lot of things. Right, it's going to feel a little bit like that section we just read about dealing with crime. Right, it's not going to be any fooling around with genetic issues. Right, if we get some definitive, overt, you know, planetary administration, right there, I mean, it's going to be swift and definitive, sure and swift, as they said there. Right, you know, boom, overnight, none of these people are ever procreating again. Period. End of story. I mean, it's going to have to be really definitive to get it moving, because a lot of that potential for the spirit of truth to function is limited by genetics again. So but that's the basic answer to your question is just is those accelerating influences of the spirit of truth and the universal bestowal of thought adjusters.
You've mentioned 1% and parallel stream, so mm-hmm. it wouldn't have to be a lot of the population.
Yeah.
In on this.
Yeah. Again, remember the mustard seed quality of spiritual influence. It just takes a little bit to have incredible, you know, impact. So you can take all that geometric, you know, and accelerating influence to heart. But you know, it's not going to happen in any of our lifetimes. But it, you know, it doesn't have to be a million years from now that we finally get to light in life.
Not light in life. I mean, just getting forward at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and again, if we do go into an interregnum, that'll just potentialize it all the more. It means when you come out, it'll take even less time to get to light in life. Yeah. Right? So again, the positive potential. The interregnum will be a negative actuality, but it'll be a huge positive potentiality if it does happen. I mean, one of the most incredible positive potentialities that's ever been manifested was the Lucifer Rebellion.
Sure.
Right? Right? I mean, you know, like they point out, it's like in very short order, you know, you got more goodness from that than all the badness will ever come from it. I mean, it was just a massive positive potentiality, you know, that started to actualize in short order. Okay. We went kind of late here again, but we always have so much to talk about. But that's it now for the block of civilization. We'll move into a big block of papers about Adam and Eve, not just about immediate Adam and Eve, but all of the consequences with the Andites and everything, that the whole quote-unquote Adam and Eve phenomenon. We're going to go through this long series of papers now, culminating in getting back to what the consequences of Adam and Eve have to say about civilization. Yeah. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.